On the television, a white, spidery thing stands long-legged against dark shadows. Nothing except talk has happened for a long time. My brother and sister and I are under my granny's kitchen table, wrapped in eiderdowns, half-dozing, half-listening. I learned about the moon in school. The teacher had an orange and a ping-pong ball and a torch. I learned that the man in the moon isn't real, but that after tonight he will be. Our teacher says it's not impossible that a girl could be an astronaut someday. It's hot and muggy in the kitchen. There is a clothes horse beside the storage heater, draped with nylon stockings and slips and dress shields. Jesus looks down on us with his long hair and his sad face and his sacred heart. "Who's for more tea?" my granny asks. "I think I'll have another drop of whiskey," my father says. "It's going to be a long night." "Have you not had enough?" my granny says. My granny and my aunt are pioneers. They wear the pin. "Sure, how often," my father says, "will we get to see a man landing on the moon?" Granny's lips tighten. "My father isn't like this when we're at home. He hardly drinks whiskey at all." He unscrews the cap of the bottle. "Bet," he says, "will you have a drop? For the night that's in it." "No thanks, Mick," my mother says. My baby sister wakes inside her pram. My mother rocks her back to sleep. Between the eiderdowns and the storage heaters, I'm sweltering hot. I shove an elbow out of my way. I doze. "Wake up, children," my father says. The man on the television is excited. Something is about to happen. The man on the television says that the door is about to open. Then he says, "Not yet." He explains the sun and the moon and the earth again, like my teacher did, except not with an orange. He holds a small model of the command module in his left hand and the lunar module in his right hand. The lunar module is the spidery thing we can see on the television. It's called the eagle. It doesn't look anything like an eagle. We wait. Granny makes more tea and orange squash for us. I need to pee. "You'll miss it," my aunt says. "Go on," my mother says. "I'll come and get you if anything happens." I walk barefoot down the corridor to my granny's bathroom. It smells of 4711 perfume and talcum powder. I look out the window for the moon, but I can't see it. Last year, we went on holiday in a tent to Silver Strand. I saw the moon every night. It rose later and later and got bigger and bigger until it was full as a shilling. I thought we'd be able to look up tonight and watch the spaceship landing on the moon. But my father said, "No, it's too far away. We can only see it on the television." When I come back into the kitchen, nothing has happened. The man on the television tries to be interesting. The Sacred Heart looks down on us, his red candle flame flickering. "Maybe they should go to bed," my granny says. "Ah, no," my father says. "They'll never see the like of this again." I doze. "Wake up, children," my mother says. The door of the lunar module is open. It frames a dark space. A man dressed in a fat white suit and a big glass mask appears in the doorway. Everything moves in slow motion, but my mother and my father and my aunt and my granny are excited now, and we are excited because they are excited. It is 39 minutes after 2 o'clock in the morning. More waiting. I half doze. At 56 minutes after 2 o'clock, the man comes down the ladder backwards, slowly, slowly, and then he touches the ground. We see the mark of his big boot in the sand, and then he's walking, he's bouncing on the moon.
Given that I've never displayed much talent for anything, and have never been particularly competitive, it came as something of a surprise to me, and a shock to many others, to learn that I'd made it into the Guinness Book of World Records, albeit anonymously. Much as I would like to be able to claim that this record involved a feat of solo endurance, such as crossing the Himalayas by pogo stick or circumnavigating the globe in a bathtub fitted with a homemade sail, I cannot tell a lie. It wasn't a solo event, and there wasn't much effort required, at least not on my part. In fact, there were slightly over a million people involved, and most of the effort was expended by one person. And as with quite a few of the memorable moments in my life, it occurred in France. To celebrate the 14th of July, or Bastille Day of 1979, the city of Paris, always on the lookout for innovative cultural projects, invited Jean-Michel Jarre to perform in Place de la Concorde. If you're familiar with Paris, you will know this as the vast, normally traffic-filled space to the left of the Tuileries Gardens and the Louvre. At the time, Jean-Michel Jarre was riding on the crest of an enormous wave of popularity generated by his first two albums, Oxygène and Equinox. Collections of multi-layered electronic music, perfectly in tune with the zeitgeist of the late 70s. I was living in an international student hostel near the Boulevard Saint-Michel that summer. Many of us in the hostel, it transpired in the communal kitchen one evening in the week before the concert, had bought his albums back in our respective homes in Ireland, Italy, or the US. A good number of us, it also emerged after one or two glasses of wine, had spent many fruitless hours trying to pick out some of the catchier sections on pianos or guitars in our front rooms in Dublin, Padua, or Albany. Some of us, it further turned out after several more glasses of wine, harboured romantic feelings for Jean-Michel Jarre's then-wife, the actress Charlotte Rampling. There was universal agreement that her haunting eyes, her exquisite cheekbones, not to mention her acting talent, rendered her unspeakably desirable. When we discovered that the concert was free, courtesy of the enlightened city of Paris, the decision was made. We would all attend. Sure, we might bump into Charlotte Rampling. We clinked our glasses. Charlotte may well have been there. But as there were over a million other people there as well, she would have been hard to spot, even with those amazing cheekbones. The event set a record for the largest attendance at a concert anywhere in the world. Our group from the hostel found itself quite close to the giant tower of scaffolding that formed the stage near the gates of the Tuileries Gardens, and close enough to a mountainous bank of speakers to feel the bass notes thump insistently against our chests. To describe the concert as self-consciously theatrical would be an understatement. Jean-Michel Jarre had surrounded himself by a bewildering array of keyboards, computer terminals, and flashing monitors. He looked more like a crazed scientist in a James Bond film than a musician. Miles of crisscrossing cables, blinking lights, and a small army of sound engineers scurrying to adjust mysterious knobs all added to the impression that what we were seeing was infinitely more complex and significant than what went on at Mission Control in Houston during a moon landing. When, suddenly, about three quarters of the way through the evening, the sky exploded with fireworks, synchronized the music, the already excited crowd went hysterical. After the concert, as we made our way back through the packed Paris streets, opinion was divided. Some of us felt it was the best concert we'd ever seen. Others, of whom I was one, had reservations. I felt as though there was a phrase on the tip of my tongue to express what was wrong, but couldn't quite manage to get it out. Despite this, we all felt pumped with adrenaline, and none of us wanted to go back to the hostel. Where to next? It's a measure of how seriously the French take the idea of celebrating their national holiday that even after a public concert with a world record-breaking attendance, there were still plenty of other musical events around the city to choose from. Somebody suggested we go to a bal des pompiers, or fireman's ball. These dances have been a feature of Bastille Day celebrations for over 100 years. fire stations in each neighbourhood of Paris open their doors to the public. Local musicians and singers perform. There's dancing and barbecues. We headed over to the fire station near Saint-Sulpice. The contrast with the high-tech extravaganza we had just seen could hardly have been more striking. On a makeshift stage, a frail-looking accordionist seated on a low stool was flanked by a guitarist and a keyboard player. A lady of indeterminate age, wearing a simple black dress, was sashaying across the stage, singing songs by Edith Piaf, in a voice that had probably once been quite good. Young couples swayed to the music. Small children danced with their parents. Handsome firemen in uniform danced with grannies. Each time the singer came to the chorus of her song, the whole crowd helped her out. The atmosphere could not have been described as electric, but it was uplifting. It was touching. The phrase I'd been searching for earlier in vain suddenly came to me. Sometimes less is more.
The feral cat comes to our door almost every day now. Blotch, Sarah named him, because he's a tabby and it suits him. I scrape some leftover fish into a bowl for him and he opens his mouth and hisses. Ah, stop that now, I say. How long are you going to keep this up? Indefinitely, it seems, though in the last few weeks, Blotch has taken to stretching out across the car bonnet or on the sun-warmed flagstones beside the double doors with only wood and glass separating us. I sip my coffee and pretend not to see him, though sometimes he catches me looking at him and other times I catch him looking in at me. I have tried to be cat-like, squinting my eyes at him, and once or twice he has squinted back. You could say that we have a sort of relationship. I had a boyfriend like Blotch once. I'd be on my way to secondary school and I'd see him with his golden Labrador on the way back from a hike up to the Three Rock. He'd look at me with those green eyes and then look the other way. He would have been up there for most of the night, and even on rainy mornings I'd glimpse him heading off and away from the suburbs of Stillorgan where we lived. The first phone call came one Sunday morning. I'm going to Enniskerry this afternoon. Do you want to come? I spent the morning trying on every t-shirt that I had. Then after washing my hair with a sachet of coconut shampoo, I put a hide the blemish stick and a comb in the back pocket of my jeans and went to meet him on the wall beside the Millhouse pub. After a bus ride and a long walk, I put my platform sandal into his joined hands so he could shunt me up and over the high stone wall of a private estate in Enniskerry. The pair of us crawled through the long summer grass so we could see two black swans on a lake. Lovely as they were, I was paying more attention to his upper arm against mine. His kisses tasted like oranges, polar mints and summer rain. And he tried to teach me to swing on a rope across the river, but I wasn't very good at it in the platform sandals and preferred to watch him with his shirt off, the muscles in his tanned, narrow back as he swung up high over the water and onto the other side. He was always swinging towards and then away from me. And the more unavailable he was, the more I longed for his voice on the phone and our trips high up in the woods or through brambles and gorse to the river and our private swimming place. Sometimes we mitched off school and met up with others to drink cider beside the reservoir. And I noticed before he did how beautiful the red-haired girl was, posing in silhouette as the sun went down behind her. We were all the time looking for beauty that summer, in the land and in each other. And through him, I began to notice the way the acoustics of concrete make birdsong sound harsh and sweet when we walked and ran through the housing estates with the others. And then how the sound of birds and wind changed, became softer, more personal, when he and I climbed through the fields, woods and mountains behind our houses, the scent of honeysuckle and buttery gorse, sausages frying on an open fire, the taste of smoky tea and cider, that last day beside the river when he didn't look out for me and the barbed wire tore through the flesh of my back. and it took such a long time before I learned to wear better shoes and find my own way to the river. But here's Blotch with the fields in his eyes. He looks tired. And though some part of me longs to smooth down that bristling fur and feel his purrs vibrate through me, another part is glad that he doesn't want too much of my time and attention. He stretches out on a mat of daisies waiting to be fed, and something alert and alive within me thrums with the fierceness of his presence. I could start to gradually move his bowl a little closer to the house, but I won't.
By the time you hear this, we'll know who won the ladies' singles final at this year's Wimbledon tournament, though we still have the men's final to look forward to this afternoon. Wimbledon is the oldest tennis tournament in the world and the only major still played on outdoor grass courts. These days, it's rare for Irish players to qualify for this tournament. However, in the 1880s, a number of Irish men and women competed at the top level in world tennis. One such woman, Lena Rice, was the first and still our only Wimbledon ladies singles champion. She was born Helena Bertha Grace Rice on June 21st, 1866. Lena, the second youngest of eight children, grew up at Marl Hill House, a two-storey Georgian mansion situated between New Inn and Kerr in County Tipperary. Lena's father died in 1868, age 41, and her mother was left to run the estate and bring up her young family. There was a tennis court at Marl Hill where Lena learned the skills of the game with her siblings. Her mother organised tennis parties and there was no shortage of good players against whom Lena could practice her skills. Lena's first serious competition was the Irish Championships at Fitzwilliam Dublin in 1889. She was narrowly beaten in the semi-final of the singles competition by the Englishwoman Blanche Bingley Hilliard, herself a Wimbledon champion. In the mixed doubles final, Rice was paired with Willoughby Hamilton, a Kildare man and future Wimbledon champion. Together, they defeated Bingley Hilliard and Henry Stone to take the doubles title. That same year, Rice competed in the singles competition at Wimbledon. She reached the final, where once again her opponent was Bingley Hilliard. Rice won the first set, 6-4, and was leading 5-3 in the second, with three match points for the title. Somehow Bingley Hilliard rallied and took the set 8-6. Bingley Hilliard eventually won the title, 4-6, 8-6, 6-4. During this tournament, Lena Rice had the distinction of being the first woman to officiate at Wimbledon. This, however, was little consolation. She returned home exhausted and devastated by her defeat. In 1890, Bingley Hilliard, the defending champion, was expecting a baby and did not compete that year. This time, Wimbledon held no fears for Lena and she had little trouble in reaching her second singles final. Her opponent this time was May Jax. On the day of the final, Rice walked on to centre court in blazing heat. She was dressed in the tennis attire of the day. This included a full-length floral dress with long sleeves, corsets, long petticoats, a blouse tightly cinched to her waist, brown boots with heels, and a straw boater hat. This time, the Irish woman made no mistake by winning comfortably in straight sets, 6-4, 6-1. In that final set, May Jax lobbed a high ball back to Rice. Neither Jax nor the Wimbledon crowd were prepared for what happened next. The young Irish woman leapt into the air and, arching her elbow, smashed the ball across the court, where it landed inside the byline for what was to be the match-winning stroke. There followed a few seconds of stunned silence before the crowd erupted into spontaneous applause. The young Tipperary woman had invented a new tennis stroke that was to become the forehand smash. A jubilant Rice received the winner's trophy and 20 guineas prize money, which she spent on an emerald and diamond ring. There's no record of Rice ever having played competitive tennis after that. Her mother became ill, and it appears Lena cared for her until her death in 1891. Lena herself died from tuberculosis in 1907. She was only 41. She was buried near her parents in a small cemetery at New Inn. Had her very promising tennis career not been cut short, she might have become one of the world's great tennis stars. As it is, nearly 130 years on, Lena Rice remains the first and only Irish woman to win a Wimbledon title.
In recent weeks, a line from The Ancient Mariner keeps popping into my head. Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. Water is our mother's milk, so to speak, one of the four elements that traditionally constitute the basis of life. Yet water pollution is constantly hitting the headlines, whether it's the leakage of sewage from the Ringsend treatment plant or the pollution of the River Tolka in County Dublin. In November 2018, the Environmental Protection Agency reported that water quality in Irish rivers was, quote, going in the wrong direction. One of the worst polluted was the Avoca in County Wicklow. The problem is deep-rooted. If you believe nature is basically inert matter, it makes it easy to strip it, chop it up, or dump your rubbish in it. But if you see the earth as a living thing, and rivers like the veins on its body, then it's less easy to harm or destroy it. The key thing is imagination. In 1992, a British judge compared the victim of a crime to, quote, the face of a beautiful woman scarred by disease. The victim was a river named the Creedy in Devon, and her scar was caused by disfiguring foam generated by sewage works. The judge might have used a different image for the Creedy, such as a rabid dog foaming at the mouth. But in choosing the face of a beautiful woman, he was implicitly acknowledging the deep connection between nature and the feminine principle, a linkage that goes way back into prehistory to the earth goddess, known in Greek culture as Gaia. In ancient times, water was sacred, a gift from the gods or God. In Psalm 114, God is described as the one who, quote, turned the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a fountain of water. In the Shinto religion, wells, streams, and waterfalls are believed to be protected by deities known as Suijin. In ancient Greece, rivers were the homes of semi-divine nymphs known as naiads, the daughters of Zeus himself. And if you visit someone's home, you mind your manners, don't you? If it's a house, you don't empty your pockets and scatter dirty tissues on the floor. If it's a river, you don't dump shopping trolleys or bags of waste. The naiads were also associated with healing. The Greek traveller Pausanias relates that at a place called Samarkon in the western Peloponnese, there was a local river in which the naiads were believed to cure unsightly skin disorders. The afflicted would go there and pray to the nymphs, then swim in the river and leave, quote, their old uncleanness in its water, coming up sound and of one colour. In some rivers in Ireland, the reverse of the Samarkon experience is true. You go for a swim and get uncleanness from the river, coming up unsound and of more than one colour. I've heard it said that stomach problems resulting from the famous Liffey swim are informally known as sluice belly. What a perversion to go from waters that heal to waters that give you sluice belly. Our actions are guided by the way we see the world. And if we see a river as the face of a beautiful woman, or the sacred home of healing deities such as the naiads at Samarkand, we will marvel at its beauty and the living energy of nature. And in our marveling, we will naturally care for our waterways. But if we don't have such a vision of nature, our rivers, which could be like the rivers of paradise, will become like the rivers of the classical underworld, the river of woe, Acheron, the river of lamentation, Cocytus, the river of burning, Phlegethon, and the river of shuddering, Styx.
Soul. The scent of the rose is a path to the moon. The full moon is a butterfly's wing. Anam. Kurut Rosh Shli Nagali Shkihan Felakon on Yalak Lawn.
On this morning's programme, we heard Bouncing on the Moon by Monica Corrish, then Bastille Day 1979 by Conall Hamill. After that, The Fields in His Eyes by Lanny O'Hanlon, then Irish Queen of Wimbledon by Tommy O'Rourke. That was followed by Rivers of Life by James Harper, and finally just there you heard Soul Anam, a poem in English and Irish by Vincent Woods. The first piece of music on this morning's programme was Moonglow, played by Artie Shaw and his orchestra. Then, the unmistakable voice of Edith Piaf performing L'Accordionista. After that, we heard Dancing in the Moonlight by Thin Lizzy. That was followed by Lawn Tennis, composed by Willem Pedersen Berger and played on piano by Stig Ribbing. And the final piece of music this morning was After the Gold Rush by Neil Young.